Against all reason, I suggested the basement bathroom, telling him we couldn't open the small window because my father had sealed it for the winter. That was only partly true. My dad had put clear plastic on the window frame to reduce the draft, but the window opened simply by raising the bottom half. He took us to the basement bathroom, motioned us inside, and said, "Tell your mommy and daddy you've been good little boys." He wedged something against the bathroom door to keep us from escaping. We heard the door to the garage open and close as the gunman left. I started to shudder as the adrenaline wore off. Shaking, I looked at the little window, and suddenly the gunman's face filled it. He was checking the window from the outside. The sight made me gasp for air. After his face disappeared, I told Pete we were going to stay there until Mom and Dad came home. Pete had other ideas. He said, "You know who that is? He's going to hurt other people. We've got to get help." In my shaky state, I don't think it fully dawned on me what Pete was saying, or how the evening might have played out if our 19-year-old sister Trish actually had been home. Instead, I resisted. I was afraid. Pete argued with me briefly and then announced he was leaving. He pulled the plastic from the window, turned the half-moon latch, and raised the window open. He swung himself out feet first and into the backyard. Though it was probably only a second or two, in my memory I stood for a long time contemplating the open window and the dark night. Should I stay or should I follow? I swung my feet through the window. The moment they hit the cold dirt of my mother's garden, I heard the gunman shouting. I dropped to my hands and knees and crawled furiously into the thick bushes at the back of the house. The gunman already had grabbed Pete and now was shouting toward me, "Come out of there, kid, or your brother's getting hurt." I emerged, and the gunman berated me for lying to him. Fresh out of another clever lie, I replied, "We'll go right back in," and I moved toward the open window. "Too late," he said, "against the fence." For the second time that night, I thought I was going to die. That was until I heard our neighbor's huge Siberian husky, Sundance, bound into our backyard with his owner, Steve Murray, the high school German teacher and football coach, bounding in after him. The next seconds are a blur in my memory. I remember running from the gunman into my house with Pete and Coach Murray close behind and then slamming the door behind me. We locked the door, leaving the gunman outside to terrorize Coach's wife and mother, who had followed him toward the commotion at our house, a move that makes me cringe with guilt even decades later. We then raced up the stairs, turned out all the lights, and arming ourselves. I held a large butcher knife. We didn't have 911 in those days, so we dialed the operator, and I asked to be connected to the police. I spoke to a dispatcher who kept telling me to calm down. I explained that I couldn't calm down, that a man with a gun was at our house and he was coming back and we needed help, now. We waited by the front door in the dark and debated going after the gunman. A police car pulled up in front of my house. We blinked the front lights and the car came to a stop. We ripped open the front door and ran straight at the officer, me barefoot and holding a large butcher knife. The officer quickly stepped from his car and his hand went to his weapon. I shouted, "No, no," and pointed toward the Murray's house. "There he goes, he has a gun." The gunman burst from the Murray's front door and took off running toward the nearby woods. As police cars from many jurisdictions converged on our little street, I jumped on my Schwinn 10-speed barefoot and pedaled the quarter mile to the church hall where my parents were taking ballroom dancing lessons. I jumped off the bike, letting it crash, ripped open the church hall door, and yelled, "Dad!" at the top of my lungs. Everyone stopped, and the crowd moved toward me, my mother and father in the lead. My mother started crying the moment she saw my face. The police didn't find the Ramsey rapist that night. A suspect was arrested days later, but the case was never made, and he was released. But that night, the long string of Ramsey rapist robberies and sexual assaults stopped. My encounter with the Ramsey rapist brought me years of pain. I thought about him every night for at least 5 years, not most nights, every night. And I slept with a knife at hand for far longer. I couldn't see it at the time, but the terrifying experience was, in its own way, also an incredible gift. Believing, knowing in my mind, that I was going to die, and then surviving, made life seem like a precious, delicate miracle. As a high school senior, I started watching sunsets, looking at buds on trees, and noticing the beauty of our world. That feeling lasts to this day, though sometimes it expresses itself in ways that might seem corny to people who, fortunately, never had the experience of measuring their time on this earth in seconds. The Ramsey rapist taught me at an early age that many of the things we think are valuable have no value. Whenever I speak to young people, I suggest they do something that might seem a little odd. Close your eyes, I say. Sit there and imagine you're at the end of your life. From that vantage point, the smoke of striving for recognition and wealth is cleared. Houses, cars, awards on the wall, who cares? You're about to die. Who do you want to have been? I tell them that I hope some of them decide to have been people who use their abilities to help those who needed it. The weak, the struggling, the frightened, the bullied. Standing for something, making a difference. That is true wealth. The Ramsey rapist didn't drive me to law enforcement in any conscious way, at least not immediately. I still thought I wanted to be a doctor, and became a pre-med student with a chemistry major at the College of William and Mary. But one day I was headed to a chem lab and noticed the word death on a bulletin board. I stopped. It was an advertisement for a class in the religion department, which shared the building with the chemistry department. I took the course, and everything changed. The class allowed me to explore a subject of intense interest to me, and to see how religions of the world dealt with death. I added religion as a new second major. The religion department introduced me to the philosopher and theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, whose work resonated with me deeply. Niebuhr saw the evil in the world, understood that human limitations make it impossible for any of us to really love another as ourselves, but still painted a compelling picture of our obligation to try to seek justice in a flawed world. He never heard country music artist Billy Currington sing, "God is great, beer is good, and people are crazy," but he would have appreciated the lyric, and although it wouldn't make the song a hit, he probably would have added, "And you still must try to achieve a measure of justice in our imperfect world." And justice, Niebuhr believed, could best be sought through the instruments of government power. Slowly it dawned on me that I wasn't going to be a doctor after all. Lawyers participate much more directly in the search for justice. That route, I thought, might be the best way to make a difference. Chapter 2. This Thing of Ours. Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. Al Pacino as Michael Corleone, The Godfather, Part 2. There are 94 federal districts in the United States, each presided over by a United States attorney nominated by the president and conferred by the Senate. The offices vary greatly.